All right. PG-13. There's a reason for it. Not in what you might think. It's just that I say so many words so many times, and then there's the actual logic of the argument does depend on some things that are PG-13. So no sensationalism, but there's going to be some logic in cutting down the logic, what's called a revisionist view. It's going to take some words being used that will naturally bring up conversations with parents if kids are in here. So just be aware of that. The title of today is Marriage is the Primary Social Order. So what we've done is we've gone to the New Testament. We've seen how Christ the King has changed the status of things and how it hasn't. We've looked at all that. Now we're ready to go back to the beginning of the Bible and then go through the biblical definitions of the state and use of force and all these various things. And we're going to start with marriage. And hopefully it'll be clear why we're starting with marriage. If it's not, let me read you this statement in the New Testament from Jesus in Matthew chapter 19, verses 4 through 6. Matthew 19, 4 through 6. Jesus answered, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate." So of the social orders in creation, marriage, and by extension the family, is primary. It's already been sufficiently demonstrated in weeks 2 and 3 when we talked about the image of God. But now we're going to proceed to explore the definition of marriage and the family to trace out its contours and to show what's at stake in its defense against those who would revise the definition. We'll get to that chart. The chart's going to cover everything as far as possible views you can hold about what the nature of it. And by the way, every definition of marriage is political. There's no escaping that. If somebody tries to make the argument that the government shouldn't be involved in that, part of what I want to show you today is that that's not even logically possible. The libertarian view is we love libertarians. I've been one officially in the past. But one of the things you're going to see today is that it's not a logically possible view. I didn't say it's not a psychologically possible view. Lots of people make that very superficial, shallow mistake. But what we're going to show is not even a logically possible view. So, here's the 4 points. Here's the 4 places we're going today. Number one, we're going to narrow down the possible definitions of marriage. So our first point is just that chart. We're just going to go through the chart. Secondly, we're going to show the incoherence of the revisionist definition. And that's all the way over here. This is where all the noise is coming from today. The definition called same-sex marriage, which I'm going to show is a square circle. But that's the revisionist view of marriage. We're going to show the incoherence of that. Thirdly, we're going to show the insufficiency of the conjugal view, which is the view held by so many conservative voices today against revisionism, but we're going to show that it winds up only making a pragmatic, function-based argument. That's insufficient. So our third point is going to say, that's not enough. Fourthly and finally, we're going to make the point that all parties believe that the state has a rational interest in marriage. It has come up in Supreme Court decisions. The language, particularly and most famously in 1992, Romer versus Evans in Colorado, when the citizens of Colorado voted against giving extra benefits to homosexual couples, the Supreme Court struck it down on the grounds that there was no rational interest, which shows that the authors of that opinion in the Supreme Court need a little brush up in logic and what the words rational interest mean. We're going to show today that the arguments, any argument on any side, has the state defining marriage. Okay? And the big idea, similar to that fourth point, the big idea that we're going to drive toward is that all positions logically lead to the state defining marriage. Now, does it create the definition? No. I'm going to show you two kinds of defining. But the big idea is that all positions logically lead to the state defining marriage. You say, I don't like that. You may not. You may not like the study of logic. But if you study logic with us, even in our academy, you will see that you actually cannot verbally come up with the argument for the state not defining marriage. In all cases, It is inescapable that the state will define marriage. And I'm going to prove that today. Number one, narrowing down the possible definitions of marriage. That's the chart right there. And let me just describe the chart visibly for the audio land. Marriage on the top, and then branching down into two possibilities, Roman numeral 1 and 2. On the left, covenant. On the right, contract. That's Roman numeral 1 and 2. Branching downward from 1, covenant, is A and B, old and new. In other words, is the covenant of marriage rooted in the old creation or the new creation? Okay, you see right there, we defended that it's rooted in the old creation. The Roman Catholic view is going to say that it's rooted in the new creation. Over on the right, under Roman numeral 2, marriage is a contract, you'll have the two secular views today arguing, the conservative versus the liberal. A, conservative, that's the conjugal view. B, liberal, that's the revisionist view. Okay? These words are not made up by me. These are the words that are used in public debate, and the ones on the right on the left are the more theological words, covenantal versus sacramental. All right, so let's get into this. Explain the chart. First of all, we're going to treat the realm of general definition. According to Andreas Kostenberger in his book, God, Marriage, and Family, he says there are basically three definitions of marriage. And I don't disagree with him. I just think this is the best way to delineate the whole thing. But he says, number one, the sacramental position. Number two, the contractual position. And number three, the covenantal position. The first, that marriage is a sacrament, is not going to concern us too much today. But just briefly, it's the Roman Catholic view. They begin with looking at the words. The Greek word that Paul uses in the New Testament is mysterion, and its Latin counterpart is sacramentum. And then they will reason, doesn't Paul even say in Ephesians 5 that marriage is a gospel mystery? It is a sacramentum, symbolizing what Christ does in the gospel. Well, of course that's true. But the conclusion of that argument is assuming another hidden premise. You have to assume to make that connection that God's law for marriage begins in the gospel. Now, it doesn't begin and end in the gospel, which we would agree with that in a sense, but it begins in time in the covenant of grace, in other words, for Christians only, rather than beginning in the old covenant of creation for all mankind. But that is a false assumption, as we've already proven from Scripture. We have shown that marriage is the principal social order, the primary social order of the old world, not of the new. Now we find out it has more meaning in the gospel. Okay, it blooms in a sense in the new, but it's not rooted in the new. And therefore the Roman doctrine of sacramental marriage falls. But notice that the second position, that marriage is a contract, is going to be wrong for the exact same reason, in addition to other reasons. Both of them, in a sense, are contracts of sorts. In other words, man is still defining what marriage is. The contractual view of marriage comes out of the Enlightenment, and particularly that strand of modern thought that began to view all social spheres as the creation of individuals giving their free consent. Over here, all the way on the right, we have a picture that's just the word consent, and then flowing from consent, arrow to the right, marriage. And that's just symbolizing that marriage is the creation of the consent of its parties. As opposed to on the left, if it's a covenant, it's God. We're not erasing consent, but through consent, marriage is an ordination of God. Every single marriage is God's doing. Now, at first, if you don't see those two pictures, it might seem to us that the idea of a contract and the idea of a covenant is a distinction without a difference, a mere semantics issue, but that is not so. The one is secular to the core, and the other is sacred. Now, it's important. In the Christian worldview, we're not against the secular. We're not against consent. But God does not base his ordination on that consent. Rather, the consent is an instrumental cause that God uses. Okay, so that's very, very, very important. We're arguing for a thing that has an eternal nature. The biblical view is the covenantal view. We've already introduced it in our text from Matthew's Gospel. Jesus directly quotes Genesis 2:24. You may have noticed that. And he was reminding us that this is God's own covenant to all mankind at the beginning. And according to Jesus, the logical word therefore in that verse in Genesis 2:24, Jesus is claiming that Moses was making a logical connection between their sexuality and the one flesh union. Because God made them male and female from the beginning, therefore a man shall, which man? One man? Man when it's popular? Christian man in the church? No. Every single man who is married, he's not arguing against singleness, don't get the wrong idea. He's saying, marriage is only this. Because they are male and female, therefore, marriage. And if that's not enough, Jesus expressly forbids anybody to undo that in that passage. Paul also quotes from Genesis 2:24 and Ephesians 5 to make sure that Christians understand that the deeper gospel mystery of the marriage, and in fact, from verse 22 through 30, he gives us the deeper gospel mystery of marriage. But then he adds in verse 31 and 32, he quotes Genesis 2:24. He wants to get Christians to understand, don't get the idea that this is not still the same thing as it was back then. I'm giving you more information. I'm giving you the blooming of the flower, but it's still rooted. Back there, God says, marriage is this, one man and one woman. Now, the contractual view over on the right. I said they came out of the Enlightenment. If you're not familiar with the terminology, 1600s to 1800s. Was the philosophical Enlightenment, and out of that came new understandings of politics, and out of that we see the modern libertarian position and the modern liberal view to a certain extent coming out of that, that pressing of liberty or that pressing of equality out of its context, out of its eternal definitions. And so everything, the main foundation of everything is consent. Individual consent created government. Individual consent created families. If you follow that logic all the way through, then everything is a contract. Everything that's not an individual is a contract made by individuals. So with the contractual view, we can further subdivide between what new natural law theorist Robert George calls, and I'm going to quote this guy, Robert George, a lot. He is a Princeton law professor. He's a Roman Catholic. He lectures at Harvard, and he defends all the positions we do from a jurisprudence perspective. He's a member of the Council of Foreign Relations. There's a war. Not sure what that's all about. But anyway, I will tell you that you can be a conservative and still root your philosophy the same way libertarians do and liberals do in contract theory. What matters is consent. You can be a conservative and still believe that. Okay? Now, Robert George has a lot of good arguments when he's ground clearing, when he shows what's wrong with the other view, but at the end of the day, he's still going to make the same mistake. So I'm going to quote him a lot. The conjugal view versus the revisionist view. That's what I have over on the right. That's his debate. The conjugal view and the revisionist view of marriage. It's crucial at this point to note that the covenantal view that we're going to defend is not the same thing, strictly speaking, as the conjugal view. We're going to have a lot of things in common. We're going to argue against the revisionist view on the same basis of their illogical, you know, positions, but that doesn't make them the same thing. And let's remember that as we proceed. All right. The conjugal view is summarized by George as follows. If you want to know what it is, this is how the conjugal view defines marriage. Marriage is, of its essence, a comprehensive union. And this quote is from a book that George co-authored with two other people called Marriage, A Defense, One Man and One Woman, or Marriage, One Man and One Woman, A Defense. I can't remember the order, but it's a pretty thin book, pretty readable, and it's pretty good. But marriage is, of its essence, a comprehensive union, a union of will by consent, there it is, the first thing mentioned, and body by sexual union, inherently ordered to procreation, and thus the broad sharing of family life, and calling for permanent and exclusive commitment, whatever the spouse's preference. I love Roman Catholics. Their view of marriage is pretty similar to Arminians' view of salvation. Once you're in there, it's, you know, but beforehand, what? It's all determined on what you do. It's kind of like anyway, I'm not going to get into it. A lot of funny jokes there, but I don't disagree with any part of that definition. We just believe more than that. And if you don't believe more than that, you're not going to have much at the end of it. The covenantal view and the conjugal view share a commitment to elements of marriage, but the advocates of the conjugal view must remain shy about establishing these truths by any appeal to special revelation. They are really concerned to not bring the Bible into it. Let's just call it what it is. First secular view will define marriage as a comprehensive progenitive union between one man and one woman. We're going to define these words in a second. But the covenantal view will add that it is also divinely ordained. We agree that it's comprehensive and progenitive. We also would add that it is divinely ordained. And therefore, it is not subject to consent at its foundation at all. That doesn't mean the partners did not give their consent. They ought to. It's more virtuous to love someone when it's from your heart. We're not against consent. We're saying that it's secondary to the definition of marriage. Secondly, the incoherence of the revisionist definition. Why am I bringing this guy George in at all then? Because he makes a really good argument against the revisionist view, and our argument has to be at least this good, and it rarely is. So let's get into it. The fact that marriage is... Let me write these words down. Sorry, let me write the three words down that belong to this definition. Oh, I didn't give myself much room, did I? Let's put it over here. The conjugal view is going to be that marriage is comprehensive, and you'll see what he means by that in just a second, progenitive. That's part of the definition of comprehensive, so it's a clause of that. But we're going to add more to that. We're going to say that it's divinely ordained. They're not, so let's do that for the moment, because this is on their side. I'm going to show you what's insufficient, too. But let's see what's so powerful about the argument first. Here's what I mean by comprehensive. The fact that marriage is comprehensive means that it regards the totality of marriage, the sum of its object, and not merely the perspectives, the passions, or the preferences of its members. The comprehensiveness of marriage is to be distinguished from any reduction to a part of marriage. Let's ask, for example, the revisionist, the defender of same-sex marriage, revision because they're revising the definition. Let's ask the revisionist why the state should expand, and I put that in quotes, the definition of marriage. What is the essence of that definition? Why should we do that? Let's consider four offers that have been made in this debate. The revisionist is going to counter with four things. We say, we can do better than this. Marriage is, and they're going to list four things in their argument that you can say same-sex marriage is a rightful heir of the title marriage. Four things that they offer. Here's the first one. Take, for example, the virtues or the intensity of emotional investment in a relationship. Emotional investment in a relationship. Same-sex marriage ought to be marriage, number one, because of the emotional investment or emotional commitment. Let's just say that. Let's use a nice word like commitment. That is more serious than just my fleeting emotions. Okay, George responds. He says, in this sense, there is nothing specifically homosexual about the revisionist view of marriage. It informs many male-female relationships. So this thing right here does not tell us what is different between them. He says, but it books no real difference between these and same-sex relationships. Both involve intense emotional union, so both can make a marriage, according to this. Comprehensive union, by contrast, is something only a man and woman can form. And he's going to prove that. So what he's saying right now is that this by itself does not give us a difference. Your burden is to show us why same-sex marriage should be marriage and yet everything else shouldn't be marriage. Okay, so the burden of proof is entirely on the position that proposes an object of marriage which has no fixed nature to it. George continues. He says, quote, if marriage is centrally an emotional union rather than one inherently ordered to family life, it becomes much harder to show why the state should concern itself with marriage any more than with friendship. Why involve the state in what amounts to the legal regulation of tenderness? End quote. So again, to the libertarian who would say, why are you bringing government? Wrong. You're the one that has to bring government into it. You have to regulate, according to your argument so far, emotional tenderness. But what's the difference between homosexual emotional tenderness and some other two people being emotionally invested with each other? Well, we'll keep going that. Maybe there's something else. All right, let's do it. But remember that at this part of the argument, the burden of proof rests squarely on the revisionist view, hence his name, to persuade us why the government should force a revision of the idea of marriage. So far, this definition has not hit the burden of proof. Secondly, what if it could be objected that what makes the difference is sexuality? But since everybody has a sexual orientation by all accounts, the only thing this could mean is that the distinction is rooted in sexual consummation. So the second possibility was sexual orientation. But everybody's got one of those, so everybody's married. No, I don't mean that. Thirdly, sexual consummation. This is what's called in the business a reductio ad absurdum argument. You accept their premises and you drive them to show the square circle in their arguments. The act itself, that's what I mean. But this only creates an even more glaring logic problem for the position. As George explains about the fictional... Oh, he tells the story of a couple, two guys, they're in an apartment, he just goes on, he tells the story for 2 pages long, and then says by the third page, now you might have assumed that this is a homosexual couple. It's not. They're two widowers. They're two people that were old college buddies, their wives died, and they decided they're in their 50s, financially, let's just be roommates. He draws you out and gets your emotions into it so that you can assume that they're a homosexual couple. He says, nope, they're not. And then he goes on to argue, quote, would it not be patently unjust if the state withheld benefits from them only because they were not having sex with each other? A Syracuse law professor has argued that it would be. In other words, the Syracuse law professor realized, oh, there goes our whole argument again. Then that means everybody has to be married to everybody else. But that's not our argument. So they have to start arguing, yes, that would be unjust. If the state should recognize, or that the state should recognize social units made up of committed friends, the revisionist cannot answer by claiming that marriages are the most emotionally intensive relationships and that sex generally fosters and expresses that intimacy. Emotional bonds are certainly important, George says, especially in marriage, but if sex matters for marriage only for its emotional and expressive effects, by the way, you're right back to argument one, as the revisionist must hold, then surely sex is perfectly replaceable, as no one really holds. In other words, why is sex more expressive of marriage than other pleasing activities that build attachment? So notice at this point of the argument, where the burden of proof is and what's happening. The argument that we're making is not that sex does not have such a role in marriage, but that the burden of proof has not been satisfied. The burden of proof for the revisionist is to show how this should not include other consensual relationships. If you make marriage more than what marriage is, how do you prevent it from being everything and therefore nothing, and therefore legally outlawed? And so far he's showing that if you use any of these as the foundation, there's no distinction between same-sex relationships and any other relationships, logically. That's the burden of proof. So the conjugal view has no such burden, because the very nature of the case is that the sexual dimension is part of a more comprehensive design, as we're going to see. In other words, the question we have a right to ask at this point is what unifies sex and the other features of marriage as one thing? What makes them all essentially one object called marriage? We've seen so far that neither sexuality per se, nor sexual consummation, nor emotional attachment qualify for marriage's sufficient condition. The burden of proof is on the same-sex definition to show a sufficient condition for what marriage is. And the reason he can't do it is because none of those three reasons distinguish the same-sex marriage from other options not currently considered as marriage. But let's give them a fourth chance. Fourthly, it could be argued that what makes the difference is a stated commitment of domestic support and care. Matt, you're just trivializing this. These are two people that really care about each other. Okay. A commitment of domestic support and care. Of course, this would have to take the form of a contract, according to the argument. But right away, the argument runs into the very same difficulties as the other three. Because if all we're talking about is recognizing a couple caring for each other in the same living quarters, then there is absolutely no reason inherent to the case why any roommates, or even three or more people, would not also constitute a marriage. So by this fourth definition, you have proximate, and we can even put the word intense, proximate and friendly care for each other. Okay? But according to that definition, there's no reason to prohibit you from two people not having sex, or three or more people having sex, or two, three, four, or more people not having sex. There is nothing in that definition which prohibits the state from recognizing anything else. Same problem of demarcation. And all of this makes the point that the whole argument always has to come back to the intent to enter into the contractual union. That's the consent argument. When we reply to the proponents of same-sex marriage, wait a minute, you can already do that. The response will inevitably return that now there ought to be a special contract on par with marriage. It should be called marriage. But what such people cannot see staring at them right in the face is that this is circular reasoning. We are asking, what constitutes the difference between marriage and non-marriage? They'll reply, commitment to each other, signified by the contract. But then we have to ask again, what is this commitment that is signified by the contract that makes the difference? You can already draw up business contracts. Why is this a marriage contract? What is uniquely marital about the commitment to which you refer? That is the whole question. We've seen so far that the answer cannot be emotional attachment. It cannot be sexual orientation per se. Everybody has that. It cannot be sexual consummation per se. No revisionist would want to argue that what we should now call marriage is just what everybody's always meant by prostitution or fornication. Nobody would want to argue that. And we've seen that it cannot be the proximity of domestic support or care. So both sides of the debate at this point must grant that none of these four things are unique to the marriage definitions of either position. And so the revisionist's ultimate object of the contract is vacuous and bound to commit the fallacy of circular reason. But let's give them a fifth chance. Another counter-objection can easily be imagined. They could say about all four of these things, no, here's what I mean. It is precisely a monogamous commitment that marks it off as marriage. So let's call this fifth option contractual monogamy. Contractual monogamy. But the same ultimate standard of individual consent that's inherent to the contract view is going to make monogamy a mere function of the contract as well. So the same circular reasoning is going to happen. Consider that the commitment to one partner at a time is what monogamy means. The commitment to one partner at a time is defined by the consent of each party, whether there's a contract to represent it or not. But then we ask why this contract should be called more than a contract. Why should it be called a marriage? And you reply, because it's monogamous. And then I reply, what makes it monogamous? And you reply, the contract. Well, then you have my congratulations for breaking the record for the most circular arguments in one argument. Nothing in principle denies you the contract. What we deny is the contract's alleged powers of redefinition. George gives an excellent summary that some people might be inclined to think is nothing more than a slippery slope argument, but it's not. He says, quote, "We're trying to drive home a different point. If you insist as a matter of principle that we should recognize same-sex relationships as marriages, the same principle will require you to accept and favor legally recognizing polyamorous, and as we saw above, non-sexual relationships as marriages. If you think conjugal marriage laws unjustly discriminate against same-sex relationships, well, then you will have no way of showing why the same is not true of multiple partner and non-sexual ones. So the logic of the revisionist case makes every relationship a marriage relationship, and therefore marriage does not exist. If everything is everything, then nothing is nothing. If everything is everything else, then there's no one thing that's anything. And what's happened here is nothing other than the outlaw of marriage." You say, well, but I don't want that. Logic isn't about your feelings. Logic is about what is. It is the nature of what you've done. Well, so much for deconstruction. There's one more element to the covenantal view regarding marriage's enduring social function. Notice that this is not an argument for pragmatics. Now, in George's book, I think it is. I think he has to ultimately say, because one man and one woman has a function driven toward family life and the continuing of the generations and health, which I agree with him about all that, but he leaves it at that. We would go further and say that all of this is a matter of natural law. So his other ingredient, his other ingredient, that it is progenitive. Let me explain what he means by that. That it is progenitive means that it is designed to raise offspring. And consequently, its non-procreative dimensions cannot be set against its procreative dimensions. So, for example, on the nature of the bodies of male and female working as one object, and I know this might seem a little mystical, but if you're a Christian, you already believe this about marriage. George adds this, quote, "What makes for unity is common action, activity toward common ends. Two things are part of a greater whole. In other words, two things are really one if they act as one. And they act as one if they coordinate toward one end that encompasses them both. The parts of a body have their unity by nature. They are naturally incomplete when apart, naturally greater than the sum when together." Now, the statement naturally can be misunderstood in a lot of different ways. And it has been in the church. Things about infertility, things about singleness. You might see about that, but remember, and I say remember, but if you weren't in the Aquinas class, you only got a brief hint of this, I think in week one or four or something, about natural law. The three-legged cat does not disprove that cats are four-legged beings. It's the exception. So whether you're talking about homosexuality, which is a moral deviancy, or whether you're talking about infertility, which is a metaphysical defect, not a moral defect. Okay? So there's a difference. So you assume if it's a defect, all defects are equal. That's not true. Okay? So don't get that idea. We can talk about that more afterwards. Thirdly, the insufficiency of the conjugal view. Now I'm going to come back over here and say, this isn't good enough. This isn't good enough. We want to make a covenantal view. In addition to marriage being comprehensive and progenitive with respect to one man and one woman, that's hard to say. Sometimes I'm trying to go fast. I got 13 pages. The covenantal definition says more than the secularized conjugal view. We would add to all this that marriage is ordained by God precisely as a civic matter. That it is ordained means that God has created it and God has called its members into obligation. What the scriptures claim is natural law. In other words, truth about the nature of things. So we take the creation of the image of God in Genesis 1 and the creation of marriage in Genesis 2. We have the first individual and the first collective expression of God on earth. Male and female, he created them, chapter 1. "Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh," chapter 2. But our question will be in what sense marriage is to be respected by all other persons, which is where we move from the singular community called a family to the larger community of the polis. That's where we get that word politics from. It just means life together. It doesn't mean the state. That's part of the problem. We're modern statists. Even libertarians are modern statists. So when we hear together, we think, the government! Government comes last among the social institutions to protect them. Okay, so liberals, libertarians, and too many conservatives all have a statist definition up front. And so when they hear government or politics or civics or community, when they hear those words, they immediately think, Hitler! That's a perversion of the design. Okay, so let's fast forward a little bit here because I want to get to these. One more thing on natural law. When we look at natural law and we examine marriage, and for that matter, if we examine homosexuality in the history of civilization, natural law is not after pagan examples as a source or as the norm for marriage. The argument is not that marriage ought to be one man and one woman because this is the way it's always been. Or even that has worked. That's evidential. That's true. That ought to support our case. But that's not the source. That's not what natural law means. Natural law means the nature of things, even if people went a long time trying to go against that. Similarly, when we talk about homosexuality, we're not we're not simply after function or what works or what doesn't. But one interesting thing that should be pointed out is that if you look in the record of history, the idea of same-sex marriage simply doesn't exist as it does right now. People say, here's some examples of homosexuality. Here's where it's even been popularized or widespread. For example, in ancient Greece, the most famous example. But if you look at the record of ancient Greece, you will see that homosexuality does not manifest itself in anything like a claim to same-sex marriage. Such an idea is not found in that record. Rather, homosexuality has been recognized as decadent against the claims of the home, against the claims of traditional culture. When homosexuality has been championed in past cultures, it is an argument on that basis, either against the home or against the traditional claims. But the idea of same-sex marriage is a square circle that could not have been seriously argued for in more rational ages. It gets a pass because we live in a post-logical, post-rational age. Fourthly and finally, all parties believe that the state has a rational interest in marriage. No, I don't. Yes, you do. Your argument's just at the surface and nobody's poked it yet. But I'm going to poke it now, and underneath the surface, everything you're going to say to me, if you say it afterwards, will reveal as I drive you down, well, then you will have to argue that the state has to define it just differently than the way I'm arguing that the state should define it. So all parties believe that the state has a rational interest in marriage. So we come full circle to complete the case that marriage is a political object in the sense of requiring the respect of other spheres. And notice that on each of the following points that I'm going to argue for, the logic of the same-sex marriage argument, which is whether it's championed by the liberal or the libertarian or whoever, is committed to the same standard of public interest. Everything I'm about to say, the homosexual agrees that that's a public interest. The advocate of same-sex marriage agrees that it is a public interest and that the government should define it. They should define it opposite or contrary to the way we are arguing it should be defined. In short, the argument against marriage as one man and one woman is self-contradictory and hypocritical. It has to make the very same argument for itself which it denies to the traditional view. It has to enumerate reasons out of one side of its mouth why government should recognize something definite as marriage for moral reasons, and then turn around and say that government should not do that out of the other side of the mouth. So please carefully notice that as we proceed. Five arguments that George lists as reasons why the state, and Wayne Grudem does something similar, and Grudem says more than this in his book on politics, and I'll give you the citation for it if I have time, why government should have the right definition of marriage, recognizing it, not creating it, recognizing it. First of all, marriage makes people in general healthier as individuals and citizens. Immediately we start to say, that government shouldn't be scrubbing people's... What is that? I didn't say anything like that. And both are... In fact, if you say, no, it shouldn't, because people... Boop! You just said it. Because it would be better... No matter what words you use, you believe government should be stuffed with moral reasoners and everything they do should be done because it's right. Everybody agrees in that law above the law. We've said that marriage is distinguished by a comprehensive sort of commitment. And now we're going to see that marriage alone calls for such a commitment and that this begins to create the sort of person that is almost exclusively good for society. The opposite view is not, no, I'm neutral to that. The opposite view is, no, that's not true. There's another kind of person that can emerge. So you're making the same argument on the other side and you don't even know it. Take note that the argument for same-sex marriage objection has a positive and negative case at this point. Positively, same-sex marriage is morally preferable as a civic matter. That's what they'll say. It's morally preferable to either the restriction of marriage to one man and one woman and the expansion of marriage to any other union besides two committed monogamous partners. So if you start to draw this out, if you start to poke at it and say, this is what your logic does, there's no corrective. There's no reason why you should not also make marriage other committed partners, according to your definition. And if you say, and at this point it is just like the argument against homosexuality, try this one time. When somebody says, it's in the nature, it's in the genes, it's genetic, it's natural, so is pickpocketing. Everything you do is natural. Everything you do is natural. Right? How are you using the word natural? Everything you do is you doing it, right? And are you not a thing with a nature? Do you not have a way that you are? Okay? So let this Christian stop falling into this trap of arguing about genetics at this point. That is absolutely irrelevant and proves nothing. Everything you do is natural. Everything you do flows from your genetics in that natural sense. And so it proves nothing. You say pedophilia is natural. Bestiality is natural. That's not. Oh, that's different. Ah, who's bringing morality into the equation now? That's how you should argue. Stop arguing about genetics and stuff like that. Everything you do is natural. In that case, the homosexual is bound to promote not only bestiality and pedophilia, but Nazism. If we can't make a moral difference, if we can't draw a line and say, no, there's something above nature, then everything in principle goes. So that's the argument. In this sense, if same-sex marriage is really an expansion of marriage, and if that's really a civic matter, then marriage is not really different than anything else. Secondly, marriage is a bond insulating the individual from the state. The private assembly, any private assembly, has an embryonic character to it. And these marriage above all of them, that's why we started out by saying it's the primary social institution. The stronger marriages are, the stronger families are, the more government is kept in its cage. Everybody who's ever written on this subject for 2,500 years, whose writings have lasted, has understood that the stronger private institutions are, the, I don't want to say weaker government is, but the more government will respect those boundaries. So what does government do? Government that wants to grow is in the business of weakening private associations, private assemblies, and especially the family. Because the family is the embryonic social order. So one of the arguments is that marriage as an institution, the stronger that it is, the stronger the idea of liberty will be over the course of time, over against the claims of government. Hence, the one man, one woman marriage unit is literally the primal incubator of liberty. The society that would remain free has a public interest in just this unit. Now, I've never heard the same-sex marriage argument concern itself with this extra-governmental social buffer between the individual and the state, but if it did make such an argument, it would fall for the same self-contradictory reason as those arguments over there. So all these arguments are going to come right back to the insufficiency of those arguments. I'll just list the other ones. As I said, I've got to summarize them. Number third was child welfare per se is a matter of civil justice. Let me get into this one. It's pretty important, actually. Let's begin with the fact that parents tend to care which baby is handed back to the maternity ward. No, I don't have that problem. I go to a private thing. Okay, fine. But normally, when you're at the hospital, typically you tend to care which baby's handed back to you at the maternity ward. And perhaps no one in this debate would necessarily demand that the deck be shuffled otherwise, but lost in that shuffle is that the reason goes right back to natural law and marriage again. This child just does belong to these particular parents. And that is only another way to say that the nature of every single child begins in a one-flesh union that is impossible for homosexuals. That's not mean, that's nature. It is an impossibility imposed upon them by, not by social construct, but an impossibility of nature. The state can begin giving children to same-sex couples all they want to, but nature never will. Either there are laws restricting the guardianship of children, or there are not. You say, well, that's a nice example. That's a nice thing that teaches us. But what does that have to do with the policy per se? Glad you asked. Here's a concrete thing that matters. Either there are laws restricting the guardianship of children, or there are not. No rabbit up my sleeve, not very controversial. If there are not such laws, then we have legalized slavery rooted in the will of the stronger, namely the adults over the children. So if there are no such laws, we have child slavery by definition. If there are such laws, then surely one of the main considerations will be the question of who has the right to house and to transport and to make choices for children. Now, I don't know. Every time I bring this up to a libertarian, they prefer to not argue it. They simply say, oh, I've never thought about that, or yeah, because it's so obvious and so clear and so crushing to their argument, they don't even know what to do with it. But unless we have child slavery, we have laws respecting who those kids belong to and why. There's no way around that. Now, logic demands at this point that the argument for same-sex marriage either restrict the class of people who can make these choices for children, or else leave them unrestricted. Now, if the first, if they're restricted, then the restriction will fall for the same reason as those arguments. If the second, then we're back to legalized child slavery. In either case, the argument for same-sex marriage condones that this, it condones child slavery. It concedes that this definition is what it is, partly because child welfare per se is a matter of civil justice. They simply draw the lines of what is better for children in a different place than opponents of same-sex marriage. All right, let me get through that. Social superiority and environment and discipline for the family, that's another example that Grudem draws out. I would read that section, hopefully. I don't know why it doesn't have the citation here. There's no citation. Yeah, it is. Grudem, if you want the exact location in Grudem's Politics, page 221 to 233, he lays out all these arguments and more. But let me just summarize it with this. I call this the four-party problem. A little something I invented as I'm going through this. The four-party problem. And I want to erase this whole thing. Let me leave this up here, this problem, because it's another way of demonstrating it. The four-party problem. On this chart, it's just, all I'm doing is saying the same thing. I just want to cement this idea. Okay, we're going to have four things over here. On the left, in this column, we're going to have the party. These are only logical possibilities. And then on the right, I'm going to have how they are united. What is the basis of their union? So, first, two parties of the opposite sex united sexually. Secondly, two of the same sex united sexually. Third, anyone, namely two or more, united non-sexually. So think of that, those two roommates. What am I doing here? I'm taking the air out of the room for anybody that in some weird way wants to get around this. Fourth, more than two united sexually. So, I have covered every possible combination of human relationships to show that if you are in favor of this, you are in favor of outlawing marriage. If you don't understand that, stop pressing buttons because you're hurting people. Okay, and just take some logic for a couple years and figure it out after that. As you can plainly see, there is no objective reason to define number two as a marriage and not also three and four. You see that? According to the same-sex marriage argument, there is no reason whatsoever to define this as a marriage and restrict these. And if that's the case, then at first, by doing this, you've actually done this. They're all on the same par, the same kind of contracts, which is at that point no different than any other contract. You say, no, it's the sex. No, it's not. Remember? Oh, I didn't write it. Oh, no, it's over here. Oh, it's non-sexually. Okay? That's every combination of human relationships. You now have no reason to do it except to outlaw marriage, which, voila, is exactly the motive. Okay? I understand that people don't understand this. I understand that people haven't taken logic. I get that. We have to be nice when we're drawing up logical maps like this and crushing logic. But those are your options. A number of facts from the present debate seem worth pointing out that'll show this, I think, pretty clearly. In Hollingsworth versus Perry in 2010, the proposed amendment to the California State Constitution was declared unconstitutional. The original, even Californians said, nah, not ready for it yet at that time. The original portion said that marriage was between a man and a woman. Now, when the people had decided to add that language, that no benefits of marriage aside from the definition itself would be denied to homosexuals, this was declared unlawful. Let me rephrase that. The students, they were good students at this point. The citizens of California saw the same-sex marriage usual arguments and they said, nope, we won't deny to you anything that you mean except for the name. You can have anything you think is being discriminated against you except for the name. And the advocates of same-sex marriage in the Constitution and the U.S. Supreme Court said, nope, not good enough. Which shows their colors. It tells us exactly what all the other contests tell us, namely that this debate has nothing whatsoever to do with equal protection under the law, but completely with redefining marriage by the force of law. In this proposition, the people conceded everything but the definition. Anything that could constitute a denial of rights was stripped away from the language. Anything that would satisfy the demands of the contracts, which participants in such unions can already redress, was protected. And the law was still struck down. And that brings us to our last point. There is no such objective thing as an expansion of marriage rights in any event. That's Orwellian newspeak. Expansion means outlawing by the force of law. Ask a proponent of same-sex marriage what they want out of a marriage. I have done this before. I have sat someone down and say, tell you what, here's the pen, here's the paper. You've got the classroom, you've got the fountain, you've got the floor. Put in a circle everything that you mean by marriage, that same-sex marriage should include. Everything that you think is deprived as a right from same-sex marriage couples. And when such a list is complete, you ask them to draw that circle around that list and then ask them for the pen. And now with that pen, write down next to the circle the words civil union or contract. They will object. No, it is the right of marriage that is being denied to us. Well, then remind them that they are allowed to define it however they wanted to, and even list all of the things that they were being denied as the constituent properties of this right. And at the end of the day, none of that is what is being demanded. What is demanded is the word. It is the banning of traditional marriage. It is the force of law to force proponents of marriage to now mean something else other than what God means. That is all that is gained, and that is all that is meant by the gain. It is proven by the logic of that simple exercise. There's a lot of other things that could be said, but we don't have time for it. Whatever. But questions, comments, anything else?
Can you get to the square, square, circle, or were you going to do that?
Do you want me to try to draw one? That's it.
That is what you're doing here.
Yeah, that's what that exercise is meant to do. So if you if you're talking to somebody about this, give them the pen, give them the paper, and say, okay, tell me everything that you would consider to be a right that is deprived of you by not calling same-sex unions marriages. You can list whatever you want. You can make the circle as big as you want. You've got it. Take it all. They do that, and then when they're done, okay, great. Take the pen and say, contract. That's your argument. It's just a contract. What's wrong? Who's depriving you anything at this point? That's not what they want. They want to deprive you by the force of law. Okay, so that's the practical question. But when they say the nature question, the nature versus law. Law, the children example was a good example of that. By force of law, you can make any child at the maternity ward somebody else's. But nature can't do that for you. Similarly, you can say that homosexual unions are childbearing all you want to, but nature won't do that for you. Marriage by definition, even in the Latin, means the cultivation, husbandry. Producing children. It has to do with the male seed. That's what the word marriage means. You can't, I don't want the government to have the right to redefine trees or circles or houses. Why should this one thing be the thing that the government mandates everybody say and mean differently? So actually, the non-libertarian position is actually more libertarian, more consistent with libertarianism. It's just like abortion. I remember Brown, what was his name, Harry Brown? Running back in 1996, the Libertarian Party. And he made a line that was funny and cute and clever for 3 seconds, but it was totally vacuous. It was basically, if the government gets involved in abortions, everybody will be having abortions. And of course, he was trying to make a crack at the government being so inefficient at everything. Okay, but he's missing the point. There are some things in natural law that the government just is inescapably involved in. They must speak to, that's their whole point of existence, to defend life, liberty, and property in the individual and the social expression of life, liberty, and property, which is the family, education, and labor. They're to protect those. They can't protect them if they don't know what they are. Why should the government recognize what marriage is? Same reason police officers should have scopes on their guns. They should know the difference between the good guy and the bad guy at that point. At that point of force. You can't have non-descriptive, non-definite negative law. It's a contradiction in terms. Libertarians think that if the government's speaking or teaching or having moral, I don't want a leader to have moral fiber and be... No, you're missing the point. The government leader is a person. He's not a cardboard cutout. He's not a vending machine that you get life, liberty, and property defended from. He needs to know the difference between good and evil to defend the good against the evil. For 2,500 years, pretty simple stuff. Now, we're confused.
Another question then,
yep.
The moral side, with regards to when you're talking about the universals or particulars or natural and you know, the upper story, when we're talking with someone who's homosexual or they argue, why can't you just accept me for who I am, it's like a good counter argument as well. I love to steal cars and take them to chop shops. You can just accept me.
Right.
Who I am.
Yeah.
And they don't like that because they see it differently. And so, when despite all the studies done and genome and everything, and conclusively finding there is no gay gene.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about let's say how many years from now they actually find something like that?
Right.
Can you talk about how God is still God, and we're still, morally depraved. How would we, I'm not trying to get God off the hook.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
How do you find that?
Genetics are just a part of nature. If that part of nature is inconclusive, and all genetics means, same root word in the Greek as Genesis, beginning or origin, what is it the beginning of? More nature? More stuff? Oh, sorry. So this is a superior, metaphysically, what nature is superior to what's inconclusive. So let's say that and so when I said that before, of course, I don't mean to, I'm aware of that there's actually no gay gene being found. You say the same thing about a drunken gene. There's a drunken gene! And these people over here tend to have that more than that, but I won't be racist, so I won't, they're the same people that, everybody's a racist and everybody's a sexist and homophobe. They'll start doing that to excuse more people, but it's the same thing. It's not that they're, is there a proclivity to do that in nature? Yes, but it's not a gay gene or a drunken gene. There's proclivities because you move from the genome to the, or the, oh, genome, to the, come on, to the phenotype, genotype to phenotype. You have traits that are the result of that particular code. But of course, that says nothing different from one person to another. You can always map people off into different proclivities, but that does not in any way speak to whether it's right or wrong. Again, everybody that's ever, I would suggest there's probably more people that have, there's probably more murderers traditionally than homosexuals, but even if not, there's more, let's put murderers, thieves, and come on, something else that's also a civic matter. I can't think right now. Perjurers, rapists. So let's at some point, you'd have to admit that there's more of those people than those people. Are they not genetically bound to do that? Yes, they're the ones that did it. It wasn't somebody else's genetics, it was theirs. So, of course, this may be conclusive on our side of the argument right now too, but let's say there's a 20-50 year period where there's a paradigm shift where they think, oh, there it is, there's the gay gene. It wouldn't change a thing. This comes before this in the argument. All it shows is that they have those proclivities toward that, just like everybody else's proclivities toward all the things that they do. It doesn't decide whether or not behavior is good or bad. Yeah. Always mark the people who say that things are genetically predisposed in human beings. They show up one year being the champions of compassion and diversity and celebrating everything wonderful. Watch those people. Those are the people that stuff people in gas ovens. They're creating a pretext to off certain genetic types as opposed to other genetic types.
Shouldn't they call it eugenics?
Eugenics. Yeah. True genesis. Eugenics.
One thing about the triple spirit that we all have the same rights.
Yeah.
We all have the right to get married to someone of the opposite sex.
Mm-hmm.
So, throughout, we're actually creating a whole new
thing for them, a new set of rules and rights for them.
Right, and of course, somebody could argue, yeah, but in states there have been these laws and these laws. That's a separate question, we can argue about that. But the question right now is, as things stand right now, do homosexual couples have every right to form such contracts, such as in their argument they say marriage is reduced to? Absolutely. Nobody's stopping them from that. What they want is for everybody else to recognize that as a marriage. And that effect, as we say, oh, it's a slippery slope argument. The guy that can't make the cakes for this, the guy that can't refuse this service, the churches have to do that. In my clean white room, libertarian room, where there's just a white room, and you start with liberty, well, that wouldn't happen, and that wouldn't happen. Well, we live in the real world, and it does happen.
I have a question with that, because what does he mean by there's a difference between recognizing a contract and creating a contract?
Yeah.
It kind of sounds like we're talking about the state being okay to create.
No. Nope. So I did a blog on it. I actually have it in my notes. I'll give you the notes. I didn't get to it. But I call it recognitive definition. Which, by the way, you can't believe in natural law or God if you don't believe this. When government gets something right, you'd want them to get some things right, right?
Right.
Are they recognizing something outside of themselves, or are they necessarily creating it?
No, they're recognizing something outside
of
themselves.
Okay, so you agree with me?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, but you're worried about somebody else who might use this rationale to have the government.
Right.
Whatever.
So, power is abused.
That's why we restrain those powers. In my view, restrains power, theirs doesn't. There's they live in a libertarian fantasy world in which they think that restraining power is as simple as throwing up this white room that nobody actually lives in and saying, wouldn't it be nice if people were more like Jesus or if they just believed in life, liberty, and property? Sure it would. But that's not the real world.
So would it be okay then to recognize the contract held out by the church? Or because, and then if there's a problem, then we go to court with that contract.
Well, with the church, that would be a Roman Catholic view. So don't make that mistake. The church does not create marriage either.
God approves.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah. And that's why you could. But even if the church doesn't do it and it's a civil judge, dude, that would still be a marriage too because of what marriage is, not because the church is the one that officiates. Ideally, the church would officiate all of them.
Well, that's interesting to think. There's a lot of people that, I know Christians that, you know, disagree with it, say that the government should not be drawing up marriage, because they're not the ones making it. But you're saying we need to step outside that, above that, say marriage is what it is.
Yeah.
And then the state is recognizing it. So you want them to be able to, you want to have contracts there so that the state can officiate disciplinary things or whatever that the church can necessarily do over unbelief.
Well, not, no, not church discipline, because that's church law. But like, for example, trafficking children. That's already an issue. The state already has to recognize one man and one woman couples as a morally superior environment for children. Not because there's anything morally superior about those people, but they already do that and they must do it. If they did the opposite, they'd still be doing it. If they did the opposite and said no children can go anywhere, then they're making a decision based on the moral betterment of those children. They're assuming.
I understand that we're going to have slavery without the
law. Right, right. But what's that based on? That's based on the definition of marriage.
The fish that's laying there in the water, or out on the ground,
right.
He's dying. He's not. He's made to be free from the water. He's more free when he's surrounded by the water.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying that's something that God made.
Mm-hmm.
This is a marriage. And, you're signing on, you're registering with the state. In this, isn't there something inherently...
That's the thing, and I would say, biblically, that's part of that libertarian worldview that has to be cleansed out, signing onto the state. As if the state is something that's sort of a wart that grew on everything afterwards. The state is God's design, and He did all these institutions to interact with each other, and that's part of how we keep government in its cage best, by interacting with it, and by being neighbors within it. If we don't do that, the problem with libertarianism is it's a denial worldview. If I just ignore that or don't live that or call it that, then I can restrain that power, and that's not the way God designed it. God designed these social institutions to be neighbors to each other and to live with each other.
Yeah. Well, I know. I mean, some flat out say that government is just evil. I mean, government...
And that's Greg Boyd's view. That's an open theist view. It's ultimately, if not Gnostic, a Manichaean view, that something is evil, this dualistic thing down here, that the devil came up with government or that human beings came up with government. And that comes out of the Enlightenment too, that idea that these are just contracts. And people try to make this consistent with Christianity, and it can't. Oh, thanks.